Good evening, everyone, and hello, and thank you for coming. The class tonight is going to be very simple. The question is not so simple. Where was God in the Holocaust? Where was God in the Shoah? I'll start and I'll say that at the post Yom HaShoah class, it will be a little more more easy, more light. When I gave it, it was exactly on Yom HaShoah, and I gave it. They said in Beit Tikva there were Holocaust survivors in the crowd who said that. So it was a little bit of a different. It was very heavy to speak about it then. It was a lot of sensitivity. Here it can be a little more light, but still, it's a very heavy topic. It's a very challenging topic. And I'll start with a disclaimer, and I'll say that I'm pretty convinced that I will not be able to convince any of you here tonight. Mostly because we're very different people, and we have different experiences. And I assume that also our approach towards challenging questions, such as where was God in the Holocaust, varies and differs between people. What I intend to do tonight is to present three different approaches. Very different approaches of different thinkers, different philosophers, all Jewish, of where was God in the Holocaust. I'll start from the most simple answer that is out there, which I personally don't like, but maybe some of you will like it. That's good. There's no problem. I can tell you why I don't like it when we learn it. Then we'll learn the second approach, which I would assume I can live with it. And I'll explain why. And the third one, which is a little bit more complicated, will be something that I personally hold according to. But again, doesn't mean that that's the only correct answer. It doesn't mean that this is the only answer, because there's no one answer for these very hard questions. I'm not sure there's even an answer, but I'll try. I'll try to give an answer. I'll try to give a solid answer of where was God in the Holocaust. All right, I'll try to give a solid answer. I'll start and I'll say that surprisingly, research has shown that most of the people that survived the Holocaust and were not religious or did not believe in God also started the Holocaust, not believing in God. And most of the people that stayed religious after the Shoah were actually religious even before. In other words, as much to our shock, the Holocaust was not such a huge did not make such a huge change for most of the people in terms of their belief, which is amazing to think about it. I try to figure out why. The research, there's different studies. I should have brought it in the page. I'm sorry. But I try to figure out why. Like, what's the reason that so many people did not change anything they believed in? According to the Shoah, I would assume that this is a huge game changer. Now, obviously, many did, but not in great numbers. Not in great numbers. And I saw an interview with a Holocaust survivor. He passed away, unfortunately, an Israeli guy. He was a rabbi after the Shoah, and he was asked by the interviewer, how come you're a rabbi? Like, how come you are so faithful and you have so much emunah and belief in God, and you obey Torah and mitzvot after all that happened? You lost all your family in the Holocaust. And he said, he laughed, and he said to the camera, he said, you will never understand it. You'll never get it. I don't even have the answer for that. And I think that's the answer. Like, how come it did not really change the belief, the emunah of so many people that went through that? We'll just never know, because we're not there, Baruch Hashem, and we don't know what they're going through. And that's just to put it as a disclaimer at the beginning. So, like, when we ask where God was in the Holocaust, we should understand that not for all survivors, it is such a huge question, like it is for the generations that are post-Shoah, that are post-the Holocaust, the second, third, fourth generation to deal with those questions, and even in a greater deal than those who really experienced the Holocaust, in a sense. Before we start, I'll say Priel, my wife, she's a guide in Yad Vashem in Israel. Specifically, she teaches Holocaust to elementary school, which is a total different field. How do you teach what happened in the Holocaust? They teach histories, those horrors, really, stories, horrible stories to fifth and sixth graders. And she told me that one of the things that when she learned at the international school in Yad Vashem, one of the things they told her when they spoke about where was God in the Holocaust, that many, many, many survivors said that they found God in those little things that happened during the their experience in camp. If they someone brought them a piece of bread when they didn't have something to eat, or someone did something nice to them, or they saw that maybe there was a small miracle or small things, that's where they found God in it. So, and if maybe that would be an answer of how so many people did not change what they believed in. But I don't want to get into this today. The first approach, again, I said I will try to present three different approaches, all right? Three different approaches of where was God in the Holocaust. The first one, and the simplest one, and the one that I don't like, as I say, even before we learn it, is called the theodical approach. You see it in number one, theodical approach. I will bring three examples of what is the theodical approach, and I'll explain why I don't like it. So theodicy, in general, means that everything that happened in the world happens for a good reason, even if we don't know why. Everything has an excuse. Everything is justified, even if we don't know why. Even if we suffer, or our parents or grandparents suffered, still, it probably happened because we deserved it. Even if we don't know why, we don't know exactly what was the sin that we did, that we deserve this punishment. But if God does something in the world, that means this thing had to happen. That's a theodicy, that's the theodical approach. And I'm going to bring three different thinkers that actually hold according to this approach. I want to start with Rabbi Yoelish, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum. He was the founder, the first Rebbe and the only Rebbe, according to many, of Satmar, the Satmar dynasty of Hasidut, which is very well known for being... Sorry? No. Who said it? I think I heard. Anti-Zionist. Very anti-Zionist. Very, very, very anti-Zionist. And as you see, Rabbi Yoelish himself, he survived the Holocaust, and he wrote a book of many, many volumes called Vayol Moshe, where he expresses his different ideas, different opinions on different things in the world, and one of the things that he's talking about is the Holocaust. And he wrote as follows, just to see what is a theodical approach. By the way, there's a short bio of every niche philosopher that we're talking about. Thinker, Terry, there's sources over there next to that. Thank you. So there's a short bio. You can read a little bit about the person. So he wrote as follows. No one can deny that due to this movement that captured the hearts of the people and violated the oath of hastening the end by taking kingship and freedom before its time, referring to what? Referring to the idea that the Zionist movement hastened the end, as the Gemara says, kirvaita ketz, in the end of the galut, of the exile. That the Zionist movement said, we have to go to Israel. We have to start to rebuild our homeland in Israel. After so many years in the exile, living outside of Israel, this is something that, according to some halachic authorities, is not allowed. Halachically, according to Jewish law, you're not allowed to actively decide not to leave, decide to leave in EA, the exile, and to move to Israel. You need to have that needs to happen in a miracle with God bringing you, and not as a human, I would say, process. And he said the idea that they did it caused what? 6 million Jews were murdered, he says. I only wrote to point out that this is clear that the impure idea of establishing a state before its time, a Jewish state, Israel, he refers to, caused us all the suffering and hardships that have befallen us. Not to mention the millions of Jews who perished in their wars against the divine will. Referring to all the wars of independence, Yom Kippur, Six Days War, and so on. Rabbi Yoeli says as follows, you know why the Holocaust happened? Because of the Zionist movement. That's a huge sin. He said, Zionism is a huge sin, and God punished us because of this. That's an example of a thinker that holds this theodical approach, who said, oh, the entire show is just a punishment. Where was God in the Holocaust? He was in the Holocaust, he punished us. Now, obviously, I don't want to be too harsh, sound too harsh when I refer to those kind of ideas, because mainly because I have respect to it, even though I totally disagree, because there's hundreds of thousands of people that hold like this in the Jewish world, that this was, Satmar is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, Hasidut in the world, and many, many people hold, like Rabbi Yoelish writes down, that the Zionism, which again, started pre-Shoah, pre-Holocaust, before the Holocaust, flourished before the Holocaust, right, in the years before, generations before, is what caused the Shoah. So that's an example. Another example of a theodical approach, kind of the same but different, the sin is different in this one, is brought by Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. I'll just say, before that, as ironic as it can be, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, he survived the Holocaust, And he survived with the help of a very great Zionist who fled him to Sweden. It was very, in other words, like, not only that, he also left many of his followers behind. And he had a lot of criticism about this. He has also his excuses and so on. But just to put that in a context, in a greater context, that in that sense. Another thinker who also holds like the theodical approach is Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. He unfortunately did not survive the Holocaust. He was murdered in the Holocaust. But he gave drashot, different sermons, in the ghetto, and he told his followers, told his students to record it, document it, so if they survive, they will publish it afterwards. So we got this over here in Akifta de Meshicha, in source number 2. He writes as follows: in these times, Jews have chosen two forms of idolatry before which to offer their sacrifices, he says. What are the idolatry? Two forms. They are socialism and nationalism. Now, when he refers to socialism, it's not only an kind of an economical approach, all right? When he talks about socialism and nationalism, he refers to secularism. Secularism, the idea that a Jew can be only a cultural Jew, have no obligations toward Torah and mitzvahs, have no obligations toward anything regarding spirituality, but he can be only cultural Jew, he can be very secular, and still consider himself a Jew, all right? Maybe refers to the Enlightenment movement in a sense, and so on. Look what he says. The ideology of the new nationalism may be defined, he said, succinctly, he says. Let us be like all nations. Nothing is asked for of a Jew, but national feeling. One who carries shekels and sings Hatikva is exempt from all the commandments of the Torah. Clearly, this approach is considered idolatrous in the eyes of the Torah, he says. These two forms of idolatry have poisoned the minds and the hearts of Jewish youth. Each has its leadership of false prophets in the form of authors and speakers who perform their work faultlessly. A miraculous feat has been accomplished. In the heavens, these two forms of idolatry have been fused into one: national socialism. Nazis, he says. Nazism. They have been forged into a terrible staff of wrath that beats Jews all over the land. The impurities which we worshipped come to beat us. That's Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. Again, theodical approach. Whatever happened, happened for the reason. There was a punishment. The sin is different. So the first sin, says Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the sin is Zionism. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman says, you know what the sin is? The sin is nationalism, socialism, secularism. But it's kind of the same idea. Now, why don't I like this? Why I personally don't hold like those ideas? Two main reasons. First of all, if we say that the Holocaust is a punishment, this is a huge punishment. It is an unproportional punishment. I cannot think of any sin as great as it can be. Even if you hold that Zionism is a sin, and you hold that secularism is a sin, and so on, it's just not proportional. Because also, Frum Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. And secular Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. And anti-Zionist Jews were murdered. Everyone were murdered. Very hard. That's the first reason. The second reason why I don't like it is because it's like fashion. Why is it fashion? Because in order to hold like the theodical approach, you just need to tell yourself, what is the biggest sin in the world? What is the thing that I fight in the world? So for the Satmars, it would be Zionism. So for them, Zionism is the number one sin. So obviously that was caused the Holocaust. For Elchanan Wasserman and his followers, it would be secularism. So obviously that would cause the Holocaust. But I'll give you a third example. The son of Rav Kook, the Ratzia Kook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, writes down, he did not experience the Holocaust. He was in Palestine back then. But he writes down after the Holocaust, and he says, you know what happened in the Holocaust? Why did that happen? It happened because Jews stayed in the exile too long, and they did not come to Israel. That would cause the Holocaust. The Holocaust is an example of what happens when Jews live in the exile. Also, it's a theodical approach. But take a look what happened. We have two different approaches under the theodical. One says Zionism is the fault. The other one says anti-Zionism is the fault. Who knows? Who knows? It's really dependent on the ideologies that is behind it. But again, I have respect to this because many, many people hold like this and that satisfies them. Maybe some of you it also satisfies. Not me. Not me. Personally, not me. I want to move to the second one. Are there any questions before I move to the second approach? All right. So
it's really a problem because in the old days, whenever we got punished, the prophets told us, you're punished because you didn't do this or you did that.
Yeah, but who knows? But who knows? Well, we don't have prophets anymore, right? Like, if he emailed God and he asked God, what do you think happened? And God told him. Like,
we got the biggest punishment and we can't figure out what it's for.
Right, like, that's a question, is that punishment or not? Second approach, a little more thought, that's the one that I said I can live with. I want to call it the radical approach. Radical approach is, it's a take on what the Rambam writes down in Mor Nevuchim, but it's very extreme, taking it to a very extreme level. And I would say the most famous spokesperson of this approach is Professor Yeshayahu Leibovitz. Professor Yeshayahu Leibovitz was one of the most brilliant thinkers in the 20th century, an Israeli thinker, very controversial for many, many, many things, but also a huge thinker, one of those who really impacted the philosophical world post-World War II. And he used to hold a very extreme approach, in general, not regarding the Holocaust, that is developed open the Rambam. He used to say that God is so transcendental, in other words, he's so much external to this world, he's so much not as part of what's going on, that he basically almost has nothing to do with this world. He's like, everything, every physical, every action, every moral decision that a human being or a nation or a group of people make has nothing to do with God. More than that, he says, the idea is that the perfect worship of a person to God is where a person worships God without looking for anything in return. No reward, no help, nothing. You only worship God because God commanded you to worship Him. That's the only reason a person needs to worship God. Anything else, says Leibovitz, is not a real faith. It's not a real faith, he says. All right? That's his approach. Very, very briefly. He writes about it in length, in many, many, many places. But the real idea of faith is just total devotion to God without expecting anything back. Why not expecting anything back? At the moment you expect from God anything back, it turns to be like this ATM machine, where you think when you press some buttons and some money comes out, and you think like God owes you something, but God doesn't owe you anything. And still, you need to worship Him. Why? Because He commanded you. That's the highest level, according to Leibovitz, of worship. Now, when it comes to the Holocaust, it's obvious what he will say. He will say, wait a minute, I don't think there is a question where was God in the Holocaust. Why was there no question at first place? Because there's no expectation of God to prevent the Holocaust from happening. He didn't even expect God to prevent this. And the writer is followed. One of the very famous quotations of him, in verse number 3, he used to say, whoever claims that in the aftermath of Auschwitz, they have lost faith in God, to them I respond with certainty and clarity. It means that they have never truly believed in God, but rather only relied on God's help. That's my belief. They'll say, I don't have a question even. Because if I have a question, then that means I did not really believe in God. Because God is so transcendental. He's so out of this world. He's so external. Then like, why would I have anything to even come in any kind of blame to God? Now, I'll give two things. One is a positive idea regarding this. What Leibovitz says is like, what's the difference between 6 million Jews that died or one, God forbid, baby that dies in a car accident? Why are we asking those questions about the Holocaust when there's every and each day there are bad things that happen to people? Things that you don't understand why they happen. Bad, truly bad, evil things that happen in this world. Awful things. But no one really questions such a big deal when those things happen. Maybe the family, God forbid, maybe the person itself that happens to him. But like, every and each day bad things happen. He says, you know why? Because God has nothing to do with this world. There's no reason for you to accept that God will do that. Why I don't like this one? I can live with it. And there's many people, I should say, in Israel today, many, many people, especially third and fourth and fifth generation already to the Holocaust, who did not experience the Holocaust, nor firsthand and nor grew up in a house of Holocaust survivors, who say, like, I can live with this. Why I can live with this? Because as time goes by, and the experience of the Shoah and the remembrance of the Shoah fades a little bit, then it's easier to say, well, maybe there was not even expectations at the first place. But what many, many, many survivors told Leibovitz is that Leibovitz, and that's true, he did not experience the Holocaust. Only a person who did not experience Auschwitz can say that he had no expectations of God saving him from Auschwitz. Because Leibowitz was in Palestine back then. He was not in Europe. He did not experience this. And many survivors said, you know what you're doing, Leibowitz? You're actually letting Hitler win. Why are you letting Hitler win? Because Hitler wanted two things. First of all, to kill all Jews. And second of all, he wanted to demonstrate to the world, to the universe, that he as a human being can do whatever he wants. That there is no limit to cruelty. No limit. A person can do whatever he wants and nothing will stop him. He's almost like God. There was no one above him. No one was above Hitler. And basically what you say, Leibowitz, if God has nothing to do with this world, if he's not going to stop him, then you say that Hitler was right. Yeah.
I know what I've done. I know it, like, kind of like my matara. I know I'm off a little bit. We're communicating with Hashem. And so he's actually, like, it contradicts that entire concept. That
he holds that Yom Kippur is so very different. Everything, again, that's a very radical, that's what I call it radical. It's a very radical approach. I can't say it has no roots in Judaism. Sorry, I can't say there's no roots in Judaism for that. Rambam already writes that the Kadosh Baruch Hu should not be understood in the tools and the senses that we have in this world, and is very external. And Leibowitz was a very huge fan of the Rambam, of the Maimonides, and so on. But I agree with you. Many people, he's very controversial. Many people didn't like his approach in general, not only in terms of the Holocaust. His approach was there is nothing more than halacha. Everything is Jewish law, prayers, everything is not as important as just obeying rules and commandments. And the idea is that you need to obey rules and commandments because there's nothing more than that in the world. Because God will not come and save you if you need it in that sense. Only commandments. Many people, again, but many people can live with it. Again, I have respect to such an approach, but many people don't like this. All right, so this is a good place. Question?
I'll wait till you finish.
Don't wait till I finish. No problem. I'm nervous. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, where's the interaction?
You're saying this is, I have a relationship with you guys.
I have a relationship, okay, but where's the interaction?
Where's the interaction?
Yeah. But, I don't see, do you see the interaction today?
No, but it's just that I was taking issue with the fact that you were saying that God has set the world spinning and he has nothing to do with it.
He has something to do with it. Definitely he has, but in his own frequency. He's in a different frequency, in his own levels. Not in what we assume good and bad. What we call good or what we call bad is a very human idea. Like, what you think is bad, other person thinks is good, so why would God come and save you from what you think is bad? Because he exists in a different frequency, I should say. Right? It's a different space. It's not this existence that we all have. Yeah, Deb. And then we'll move to the last one. Yeah. I don't know.
You know, this is the Lubavitcher Rebbe's approach. He was asked how do you explain the Holocaust, and he quoted Isaiah, who said, "Just as the heavens are infinitely distant from the earth, so are my thoughts infinitely distant from your thoughts."
Here we go. There's. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. The last one. The last approach. Which is something I hold on, at least for now. But again, a person changes. So maybe if you talk to me next year, I will not like this approach anymore. For now, I can't say it satisfies me, but it gives me at least room to think about. All right, at least that. Is what I want to call the divine concealment approach. Or in Hebrew, Hester Panim. Hester Panim, the divine concealment approach. This approach was taken by, I should say, two major thinkers. One is a Holocaust survivor. The other one was able to flee Germany right before the Holocaust. One is a Rabbi Professor David Weiss Halivni. The other one is Rabbi Professor Eliezer Berkowitz. Thank you, Johnny, for bringing the books. Even though I saw that Or Chaim has them also in the library, I saw that today, but still thank you. I will try to make this mishmash between different theologicals now, different theological approaches a little bit. But that's, again, how I live, and you may like it, you may not. Feel free to also try to challenge it later. But again, I don't think there's one solid answer. But that might give a room, at least, for maybe an accessible approach. The idea of divine concealment is not attached to the Shoah in any kind of way. It's something that starts very, very, very early. It starts already in the Torah. The Torah itself tells us that God tells us. It's brought in Devarim, Deuteronomy 31, Devarim Lamed Aleph. He says as follows, source number 4. The Kadosh Baruch Hu says that if the people sin, then my anger will flare up against them, against the people, I'm Israel, and I will abandon them and hide my countenance from them. They shall be ready prey, and many evils and troubles shall befall them. And they shall say on that day, surely it is because our God is not in our midst that these evils have befallen us. First idea is in the Torah itself. It says that God sometimes is just not there. God himself decides to just hide himself. Hide himself. What does it mean to hide himself? It means that we don't see it. We don't see it. We don't feel him. We don't see his help. We don't see like. And now this Hester Panim, this concealment, can be in both layers, both levels, I should say. It can be in an individual level. If a person feels one day that he got a very good news, Baruch Hashem, or he had a very meaningful prayer, or he had a very meaningful day, or he saw a beautiful thing, and he really feels that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with him today. And he felt amazing, such a relief. If someone was ill and Baruch Hashem was healed afterwards, and he feels that HaKadosh Baruch Hu maybe listens to his prayers and helped him and so on, then he can feel God. But something happens and the next day, God forbid, he receives a very bad news or something happens. And then he asks, like, where's God? Where is he? Like on an individual level. No one else in the neighborhood may be impacted by that. Maybe his neighbor now, he feels like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is revealed to him in such a high level. But the idea that sometimes you don't feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or you ask, where are you, is a very Jewish idea. Both, again, at an individual level that differs between people, also on a national level. The idea that there can be a group or a nation of people that say, we don't feel God. We don't see God. God is hidden. We don't see where he is. We don't feel him. Now, this idea is a very, very Jewish idea. It's an idea that comes already in the Gemara. The Gemara says as follows, in source number 5, Talmud Chagiga says as follows. They quote the verse we just read from Devarim, then my anger shall be kindled against them in that day. I'll continue. The Gemara says, Rav Bardella said, that Rav said, anyone who is not subject to his hiding of the face, meaning whose prayers are always answered, that God always reveals himself to this person, and every prayer of him answers, he, this person, is not from the Jewish people. Being Jewish, in the nature of being Jewish, says the Gemara, is understanding that God is not always there and he will not always answer your prayers. He's not gonna always be there for that. That's part of what God is. It's not something that we understand. That's part of our belief in God should include that we believe in God even when God hides himself. Even when God isn't there. Now the question should be, why would he hide himself? Where does he hide himself? What are we supposed to do when he hides himself? So this is an approach I want to use from Rabbi Berkowitz. One is Rabbi Berkowitz, Rabbi Nachman, and some other sources. And I want to explain. First of all, the idea that God can hide himself not as a sin is something that Rabbi Berkowitz talks about. And I brought in source number 6. We'll read it together. Rabbi Berkowitz says as follows. We may glean a hint of the theological significance of such an apparent divine indifference from a passage in Isaiah. And he brings the pasuk from Ishayahu. The prophet says of God, you are indeed a God that hides himself, O God of Israel, a saver. How can God hide himself on the one hand and also be a saver? How can that happen? And he says in this passage, God's self-hiding is not a reaction to human behavior when the hiding of the face represents God's turning away from a man as a punishment. That's not what we're talking about. It's not what Reb Satmar said, Reb of Satmar said, and Reb Elchanan Wasserman said. It's different. For Isaiah, God's self-hiding is an attribute of divine nature. That's an attribute of who God is. Hiding. Such is God. He is a God who hides himself. This is our God. This is our Jewish God. It's a God that is not revealed. He says, it's a God that hides himself. Man may seek him and he will not be found. Man may call to him and he may not answer. And we live with this. God hiding his face in this case is not a response to man, but a quality of being assumed by God on his own initiative. but neither is it due to divine indifference towards the destiny of man. God's hiding himself is an attribute of God of Israel, who is the saver. In some mysterious way, the God who hides himself is the God who saves. As an imminent idea of what God is in Judaism, says Rabbi Berkowitz, that's a God that he's not always revealed. Not always revealed. Now the question should be, if not for the punishment, then why does God hide himself? What do we mean when we say God hides himself? Like what? We're not playing hide and seek here. Like we're talking about lives and people, right? Souls of neshama of people that die. So what do we mean when we say that? And for that I want to use an approach. I want to use Reb Nachman to explain this, and I want to use also Rabbi Professor Irv Greenberg, who also is a very, very famous philosopher, who talks about the Holocaust. The idea is, as says Reb Nachman, that if we hold that God is infinite, and we hold like that God is infinite, God is Ein Sof, God is filled, this all spiritualism, how come he created this world? If this world is physical, this world is limited, this world is filled with bad things that happen, then like, how could God even create such a thing? We would assume that if God is everything and everything is God, then like this world would not be so physical, would not be so limited, would not be so with a lot of all those human problems. And Reb Nachman says, you know what happened when God created the world? God had to shrink himself and his light. He had to say, I'm taking a step backwards. I'm taking a step backwards so I can create this world. So human beings will be able to be here. I'm going to take a step backwards and I will create this physical limited world out of this. Now, I want to say it's almost like in education. Think about it, for example. When a baby is born, then the mother or the father feeds him, right? All the way. They just feed him. The baby knows the mother is there. Everyone is taking care of him. He's all good. But slowly, when he matures, the parents want to make sure that the baby can also just be independent and eat by himself. So the mom will put a plate with food next to him. We'll take a step backwards and we'll say, let's see how he does now. So from the mother perspective, she's there. She's watching him if something happens. But from the baby's perspective, where's mommy? He can start crying. He can try eating. He can spill the food. Bad things can happen to him when he does this. But he's like, where is mommy? I don't see her. I don't see daddy. Where is he? But the idea is that mom and dad took a step backwards so this baby can mature. So he will be independent when it comes, when he matures one day. The idea is that God retracts himself from this world, hides himself, not for him, for us. Because the idea is, and this is the ideal, I would say, world reality, is that human beings, the humanity can survive on its own as a thing. And I think independent to any kind of divine help, any kind of divine assistance in the world. And in order to do that, God had to took a step backward and say, now it's your show. You're running the show. I'm not running the show anymore. I'm not running the show. You're the one who's running the show. I want to see if you're capable of doing it. I want to see if you're able of doing it. I want to see if you're able of not failing. And we failed. And humanity failed. When I say we, I say humanity, because also the Nazis and the Jews and everyone, they're creations of God. And we were all tested. And humanity failed in the Holocaust. Humanity failed in World War II. And the idea is that we were supposed, as we say, let's take a look. The Torah says in Bereshit Tibet, in Genesis 2, source number 8, when God created Adam, it says followed. The Lord God took the men and placed them in the Garden of Eden to till it and tend it. Now, obviously, God could till and tend the garden. Why did he need Adam to till and tend the garden? Why? Because there is a purpose for human beings in the world. Because this world was created for us, for Basar Vadam. And the idea is that God slowly throughout history shows us that we're slowly becomes more and more and more independent of his help. The idea, says the Rabbi Professor Irv Greenberg, is that think about history with three phases. First step of history is from creation to time of Purim. What is most famous about Megillat Esther? What's the number one most famous thing about Esther? God's not mentioned in the Megillah. God's not there. Until Megillat Esther, we were a nation of prophets. God was talking to people straight, face to face with Moshe Rabbeinu. When something happened, God intervened. God tried to save the people. God tried to do everything we can. We knew we can rely on God. We just celebrate Pesach. God split the sea when nothing happened. When nothing else, we thought we were going to be dead in the desert. When the Egyptians come, God saved us. And then comes Purim. Exactly this transition point in history between prophets and not prophets. Exactly in the beginning of the Second Temple. We spoke about it in our series about Esther. And God says, now I'm going to take a step backwards. I'm not here. I'm not going to be absent. I'm going to be behind the scenes. I want to see how you run the show, if you'll be able to save yourself. And he says, I'm watching you. I will help you if you need. But I'm right here. And the third phase between the Purim, the story of Purim, and the Holocaust is exactly this. And then we reach the Holocaust. And the Holocaust, as Rabbi Greenberg, is exactly this. The idea that God says, I'm going to take even one step backwards. One step backwards. I'm not only letting you run the show. Now I give you power, tools, technology that makes you almost like me. You're so much independent that I'm going to take even one step backwards. The more humanity becomes independent, the more freedom we have as human beings to create, to prosper, to live, to make this world a better place using those tools that people today create brains with AI. We're almost like gods. God gave us those tools to say, the more freedom you have, is also the more responsibility you have, because freedom is responsibility. And the idea is that God takes a step backwards in the world, and we take a step forward. Because this is the direction that God wants us to go through. And the Holocaust was this turning point. Was this turning point where God said, I'm going to take another step backwards, because you have those tools now so much. And we know that World War II was this turning point, using all this technology and all this creativity of human beings. And see, let's see if you can roll, if you can play the dice now, if you're on the show. Let's see what you really tested here. But we failed. Humanity failed, trying to manage it by itself. So the idea is, the real question is, and we'll finish with that, is not where God was in the Holocaust. He was in the Holocaust. He was there. He did the Holocaust. But I think the real question is, where was man in the Holocaust? Not how God let the Holocaust happen. How did we let the Holocaust happen? Because the idea is that at the end of the day, it's our role. God is taking more and more steps backwards. Don't know where that's going to end. But we need to know that this is our role. And I want to finish with this Midrash Kohelet Rabbah in source number 9. Beautiful Midrash. It says, I think, exactly this. When the Holy One, blessed be He, created Adam, the first man, He took him and showed him all the trees in the Garden of Eden. And He said to him, see my creations, how beautiful and exemplary they are. Everything I created for you. Make certain that you do not ruin and destroy my world. As if you destroy it, there will be no one to fix it after you. The idea that Kadosh Baruch Hu tells us, I'm not going to fix after you. Because you're maturing as a humanity. This creation of the world, the universe is maturing. And God is taking another step backwards. Another step. This world that we live in today is the hardest world to experience God. The hardest generation. And it's going to become more and more and more hard as generations will come by. But that's on purpose. It's not a bad thing. That's how God controls the world. And we need to know that we have the more freedom and the more tools we have in this world, the more responsibility we have. As I told you, I'm not sure I can convince anyone. I'm not sure any of those answers can convince you. Not the first one, second one, or the third one. But I respect every and each approach, and there's many more. We don't have time to do all of those. But at the end of the day, I think it is important. That's why I like, as I said, kind of like the third approach, because it brings the ball to our court. Because we understand that God is taking steps backwards so we can take steps forward. Because we as humanity need to mature. We need to take responsibility to ourselves, try to be as independent as we can, like a baby that matures slowly from being dependent to his mom and dad. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we will learn as humanity, I hope so, together, because it's not something about Jews and non-Jews, it's together as humanity. I hope we'll be able to learn to make those baby steps and to mature a little bit more, to understand that the more freedom we have, the more tools we have, the more responsible we are. We'll finish here. Thank you very much. I said that we'll finish by 9:15, so here you go. I'll be here for questions if you want to ask some questions, if you want to... We want to leave it also good. But thank you very much for coming here tonight.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start here and then Deb. Yeah.
Do
essentially, we're discussing the fact that God is unknowable. Human beings cannot understand his nature. But here we are giving him all sorts of human qualities, and he's not turning away, he's hiding, and so on. That's number one. Number two, we talk about collective relationship of God with the Jewish people, but now we're talking about the fact that he's extricating himself from his relationship with humanity overall. Never mind his chosen people, he's allowing them to do whatever they want. And then we talk about some of these individuals talk about retribution, punishment. I mean, every morning, whoever is davening says, as this is what will happen.
Sachar va'onis, yeah?
Every morning,
punishment and reward.
You say, if you don't love me,
that's what's going to happen, right?
The beatings will continue until morale will improve. Now, one of the things that it says, it says in the Torah, right? It's ish bechat oyamut. Each individual is ultimately going to be punished based on their own sins. Now, how can 1.5 million children be punished for sins that they are not even aware that they're committing? Okay.
I think I made it clear that
what I'm trying to come to is that the question that is being asked tonight, where was God in the Holocaust, is not the right question. The question is, was God and is God at all?
Right.
Because if you read an example before.
Exists, he says, exists. Yeah.
Does God exist? Because this is the question. You know, let's go to the Torah. Before he kills the 450 prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, what does Eliyahu do? He says to them,
dance to your gods. Try to do this.
Really is God,
then he will answer
maybe
you.
Maybe he's right? Thinking or busy or traveling.
Maybe he's going to the bathroom.
Sleeping. You know what? Call him, and if he doesn't respond to you, then he doesn't exist. Well, I can assure you that there were millions of people calling him
in the Holocaust.
During the Holocaust.
But that's why exactly what I say. So you're right.
For pagan gods' existence. Is that he responds to prayer and to beseeching, then there isn't even more so the case of a real God, not a pagan God. So the issue is not to just ask the question, where was the God that I already believe in? Because the question is not just that many people turned away from their belief in Judaism, and after the Holocaust, many did, but many already started to question, how can even a God exist when all these contradictions on the written words of the Torah itself? I'm not talking about human beings who are obviously flawed in huge, huge ways when they can come up with these kind of horrendous explanations for why an innocent newborn child deserves to be thrown alive into an oven. When I was in high school, there was a fellow in my class. He wasn't Jewish. I even remember his name. And he was a very devout Christian. And one day we got into a discussion. And he ultimately became a minister. He said to me, listen, anybody who does not accept Jesus Christ is going to go to hell. Okay. He said this to me. I said to him, well, just a minute. Can a child who doesn't even know about the existence of Jesus Christ,
It's a question for Julius over here.
Who can't even make a choice go to hell because of this? And his answer was. Yes, it is. Yes, he will, because he has not been baptized. He has not been taken into the grace of God, my God. Now, to me, that idiocy is just as big as much of the idiocy that we see discussed here. I asked my mother, who survived Auschwitz, how can you still believe? How can you still believe? And she said to me, it's because I believe that I survived. That's approaching what you said earlier, how different people reacted.
I'll just try to respond. I will not be able to respond to the entire thing. First of all, thank you for sharing this.
It's more than that.
I agree. Okay. I agree. And I'll just say that I think that the third approach that I represented, I think actually can echo what you just said, because if we understand that in 1939 to 1945 and today, the relationship we have with God is not the same relationship that Eliyahu had on Mount Carmel 3,000 years ago. And it's not the same relationship we had 1,000 years ago when Rashi was there, or we didn't have 500 years ago when Rabbi Yosef Karo was there. It's not the same relationship we will have in 1,000 years from today, or in 3,000 years from today. The idea is that the relationship that humanity has with God changes, develops, and I want to say matures. Not only changes. There's a vector. There's a direction we go to. We should be happy, happy that today we don't live in the days of Eliyahu, because we're in a better place with our relationship with God. The more independent we are from this kind of connection with God, from this kind of direct relationship, the more freedom we have in the world, the more tools we have in the world, the more progressive the world. And I think it's a good thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. So if you ask, where was God when Eliyahu told the Nevi'ei Baal, go and scream to your God and he needs to answer you, I agree with you, but that's not the God of 1939. Because the humanity is not the same humanity. The world is not the same world. And I'll tell you more than that. God then, with Eliyahu, is not God with Avraham Avinu. It's not the same God. Because Kadosh Baruch Hu spoke to Avraham almost physically. Went to him, and then Avraham could argue with him, do you want to save Sodom? Don't you want to save Sodom? It was, as you see, if you go through Tanakh, and through Jewish history, slowly you see how we take a step forward and God takes a step backwards. And I don't think it's a bad thing, I think it's a good thing. That's what I can say now. I think there's way more to say here, but I want to hear also other people with your reshut, all right? But thank you for sharing this. I think it is very, very meaningful. Deb, and then we'll go to the left side of this. Yeah.
God is supposed to be a loving God. The question is...
Supposed to? What do you mean by supposed to be a loving God? It could also continue to 8 million.
Okay, but again, it goes back to he's a loving God. A loving God watching this, it's a contradiction to me. And the other thing is, Ego. So Ego was persecuted by all these things, and then the friends were trying to explain.
There's an entire, there are three chapters in the book of Rabbi Berkowitz about Ego and Shoah and so on, and yeah. There's definitely a lot of similarities.
It's just futile, trying to figure it out. In the end, Eov, his friends were told no.
Yeah, but there's also a happy ending at the end of Eov, and he gets twice from what he lost. It's a little bit different today, because only now the Jewish people were able to get back to the number they were before the Holocaust. So there's a lot of similarity, there's a lot of not similarity here. But
the other last thing is, the only positive thing I can think of is Israel coming out of this.
Okay.
Said that Israel was already pre-Holocaust.
Not Israel. Zionist movement. I'll just say something because can I just respond to this?
Yeah.
I just want to say very shortly. There is a belief, less today than it was before, but it's more common in the diaspora, I should say, that Israel, the only reason or the only justification for the existence of the state of Israel is the Holocaust. That Israel is basically a huge shelter for all human beings, for all Jews, that needs a shelter from, if something happens again, like the Shoah, the diaspora, they all know we have a shelter in Israel, we can all go and we'll be safe there. This is so wrong. And this is wrong. No, really, this is wrong. Yeah. This is so wrong because Israel has, without anything to do with the Shoah, has such a huge purpose in the world. And I'm not going to even start about enlightenment or Lagoyim, enlightenment upon the nations, and other ideas of Geulah, of redemption, that are have nothing to do with the Holocaust. So if I say, I don't want to say that Israel exists, I would say because of the Holocaust, but the state of Israel exists despite the Holocaust. Not because of the Holocaust, but despite the Holocaust. And it's something that I kept on hearing when I gave this year at Beth Tikva. There were a couple of people that came up to me and they said that. But what about the state of Israel? We need to understand that Israel exists despite the Holocaust, not because of the Holocaust. We should not try and make it a cause and effect situation. It's very important to make this clear. It's greater than the Holocaust. I want to move to this table, Ira, and then I'll get back to you. I'll just say Julius, head of just for GDA. I just want to say here, we're talking about Christianity.
And I send you, despite my words, you do receive my donation.
That's what it's all about, guys. Thank you very much.
How did you send me receipts anyway?
Perspective of what's going on in the world, and having just gone through the holiday of Pesach, how can you even ask the question, is there a God? You just spent the Pesach Seder to show and testify to the incredible miracle of having personally been taken out of Egypt and personally experienced God's miracle, which is what the Haggadah teaches, that we should each one of us participate in the Pesach Seder.